Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time it's Mary Gordon and Frank McCourt. Late critic John Leonard once described Mary Gordon as endlessly inquisitive, utterly fearless. Over the past four decades, she has published novels, story collections, memoirs, essays, and biographies. Her first novel, Final Payments, was published in 1978 to tremendous critical acclaim and was quickly followed by The Company of Women in 1981. Since then, she has published more than a dozen books on a wide range of subjects and won some of this country's highest honors. In 2006, The Stories of Mary Gordon, including new and old stories, was published and received the Story Prize in 2007. Frank McCourt's story is best learned from the pages of his memoir trilogy, which includes Angela's Ashes, Tiz, and Teacher Man. These three books chronicle McCourt's life from his impoverished childhood in Ireland to his rich teaching career in America, and all three were written after his retirement. Selling more than 5 million copies, Angela's Ashes won the Los Angeles Times Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize, and was made into a feature film only 3 years after its publication. He died in 2009 at the age of 78. Now, from the 1997-98 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here's Mary Gordon and Frank McCourt in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you all for coming. This is now the fifth time that Frank and I have shared a stage, and only the third time that we haven't been under the protective or smothering, depending upon how you want to interpret it, wing of James Joyce. So we're on our own out here. Mr. Joyce is somewhere else. And a lot of people have said to me, you know, what's it like to be on stage with Frank McCourt? And I finally figured it out. It's like being on stage with Fred Astaire. And after I figured that out, I realized that that understanding opened important new possibilities for me, because if Frank was Fred, who was I? And I couldn't be Ginger because I'm simply not blonde, never will be. It's one of the important ways that I've known myself as not blonde, not even redheaded. So I realized that when I started to think that Frank was Fred and I had to be somebody, it was an opportunity for me to realize a very important goal in my life, which was to have longer legs. So I want you to think of me as Sid Charisse. One of the questions that people ask writers who've written memoirs or autobiographies or whatever that hybrid form is that we write is, how did you remember that? How do you know that that really happened? And it's a question that probably has no good answer, because the point is that you are creating the life that the work requires. And in my case, I wrote a memoir only after I had been writing fiction for many, many years. And I actually only came to fiction after I had written poetry. And so the techniques which I used to create memoir were the techniques that I had always used as a writer, the techniques of poetry and of fiction. And one of the reasons that any of us becomes a writer is we're trying to know the world. Writing is, for a writer, her or his only way of knowing. And one of the important ways that I, beginning as a little girl writing poetry and then moving on to fiction, one of the important ways that I knew the world was through images. And so when I came to write about my father, who died when I was 7, the memories that seemed most potent and most trustworthy to me were memories that had their genesis in images. My father's identity for me was, as I said, radically bifurcated, because he died when I was 7, and to me he was an entirely loving presence, someone who utterly approved of me and gave me the tremendous blessing of really unconditional love, which is not an unconsiderable thing. And I sort of think if you have that, you can get on with anything. So there was one side of my father that was this utterly loving man, but he was a writer. He was a failed writer, but you don't have to be successful to be a writer. You just have to do it. A lot of people think you don't have to do it, that you just have to think about it, but that's actually not true. But my father was an unsuccessful writer, and he had left behind him a paper trail, which I, as his daughter and a reader, had to know about, so that I had to know from my adolescence that my father, who converted to Catholicism in 1938, was a rabid anti-Semite. And although he never concealed his Judaism from me, as a matter of fact, in a moment of Oedipal carnival, he said to me, "You know, if Hitler's really alive, and he's in South America, and he comes back, and there are concentration camps again, you and I will have to go, and Mommy won't." And I think I felt pretty mixed about that, actually. But I had to confront the fact from my adolescence on that my very beloved father was at the same time the author of heinous tracts, that my father was the victim and the perpetrator of the anti-Semitism that expressed itself most violently and horrifically in the Holocaust. So I felt I was writing not only a memoir of my personal life with my beloved father, what I was writing would also have to be, in a very, very minor way, I understand, it would also have to be a part of Holocaust and post-Holocaust literature. Because I had to bear witness to the fact that this beloved father was also someone who had done things of which I was deeply ashamed and which I had to call evil. So I felt like the book that I was writing had to be not only my personal history, but also a history which had a public dimension, something that had to bear witness to the crime of anti-Semitism, that had to bear witness to the way that immigration affected people in America. My father was born in 1894, and so he really came of age during the First World War and in the teens and 20s, when the pressure on Americans was to assimilate and to be good Americans, to hide your roots. So I tried very hard to write a memoir that would be based in image, based in the poetry of memory, but also based in the facts of a history of the Holocaust, a history of American life and American immigration. And in doing that, I did call on some of the techniques that I had used as a fiction writer, because one of the things that I think fiction or all literature gives us, and I think the opposite of literature is not life, but the opposite of literature is the soundbite. And what literature can offer to us, and I believe uniquely because of the dimension of time that it suggests, is that things are themselves and possibly their opposite and possibly a few things in between. And in a world in which we want to flatten things out, we want things to be as simple as possible, it seems to me the great growth in the appetite for fundamentalism is an appetite to make things simpler than they really are, because the complexity of life can seem unbearable to us.
And in support of the previous speaker, I agree with everything she says. I feel like an interloper when I'm in the presence of Mary Gordon because I've written one book and she's been writing all her life practically, volumes, fiction, a memoir, essays. She's a teacher. I'm a teacher myself. But I haven't, I've only done this one book and here I am in her company. I do feel like an interloper and I'm wondering why I'm here. But it was this memoir of Angela's Ashes that I had to get out of my system. If I hadn't done it, I think I would have gone into the grave howling. It was the one thing I had to do in my life. With all the experiences I've had with teaching and getting married and getting into some scrapes here and there, at the back of my head, the main thing was to write this book so that I could show the face of poverty in Limerick. Not that I wasn't particularly interested in writing about myself, although I suppose I'm the center figure. I'm the mouthpiece, the medium for describing this particular period in this particular place at that particular time in Ireland and in the history of the world. I was born in New York. I don't really know what borough I was born in. My mother would never tell me because I was conceived under illicit circumstances. So I don't know what borough I was born in. But I've always been interested in the family story, my mother and my father meeting in New York and having me. And then in the awful situation in Brooklyn when she had a little girl who died when she was 21 days old. My mother had 6 children in 5.5 years, and 3 of them died in that time. And it wasn't until I was in my 50s, I think, that I began to count on my fingers and realize what she had gone through. Because the Irish Catholic woman didn't know any better in those days. You couldn't say no to your husband. A woman who said no to her husband had to go to confession and say that she'd refused to do her wifely duty. If a man came home drunk and jumped on Mary, she had to assent. She had to give way to him and have another baby. And this was the lot of Irish women in those days in Ireland. Even in America, Irish Catholics had to put up with this because the only purpose of marriage was procreation. Anything else was forbidden. God forbid that you might enjoy it. That was just a side effect of it. And if you were enjoying it too much, you better go to confession and confess that too. And I know that my mother was a lusty woman. I think we were endowed with that, all of us, that kind of lust or lustiness, if you want to call it that. And that's what got into trouble. It was ridiculous that she had so many children in such a short time, and that she was that her health deteriorated to the point when that little girl died, she had a mental breakdown, and we had to go back to Ireland. Going back to Ireland in those days, or any days, coming from America, was a dramatic business, because when you left Ireland, in the old emigrant days, when they went on great liners, Cunard liners across the ocean, when you left Ireland, you left forever. They had an Irish wake. That meant you were going to die, that you might as well be dead, because they had a wake. The American wake, they called it. So if you did, when an occasional Irishman would come back to Ireland, or an Irish woman, when they went back to Ireland, they better look like a Yank. You better look prosperous. They used to say, "Did you see Nora O'Mahony back from America? Doesn't she look fine and fat?" Nobody understood the concept of diet. "Doesn't she look fine and fat?" So if you came back, you wore clothes that were obviously American, and you looked successful, and you had a few dollars to spend. When my parents arrived back in Ireland with us in tow, my brother Malachy and the twins, Eugene and Oliver, and one child already dead, my father was a failure. And when they arrived in Limerick, they were treated with great contempt by my mother's family. and by my father's family in the north of Ireland, because they hadn't brought back the American dream. You were supposed to come back looking successful. So my father then was immediately an outsider on various counts. He was a failed Yank, and he was a northerner. He came from County Antrim, way up north, and it was whispered that he may have had in him a streak of the Presbyterian. It was suspected. And, of course, that infuriated all of us, the idea that any of us might have a streak of the Presbyterian. Then I was back in Ireland last year, up in the north of Ireland, in the town of Ballymena, where my only surviving aunt lived. And my cousin, Therese, whispered to me, you know, we just found out something, that her sister, Maura, was going through records in Belfast and found out that my grandmother was a Presbyterian. And my cousin Therese said, don't mention it to Aunt Eva. So we went to the house. I said to Aunt Eva, what's this about your mother? That's right, she said. That's because they didn't want to. And she said, not only did she want to talk about it, but everybody suspected my Aunt Eva of being fairly proper. But she said to me, Francis, how shall we begin the evening? Shall we have a little drop of the whiskey? She's 91 years old, and she brought out the drop of the whiskey. And she told me the whole story about how her mother, my grandmother, was a Presbyterian. So these are the elements that Mary has certain elements and ingredients in the Shadow Man, and I had to deal with other, not problems. There was none of that anti-Semitism, none of that terrible stuff of the 20th century. The great problem in my life was my father's alcoholism. If, there's always the great if my father hadn't been a drinker, if my father had brought home the wages, we would have had some dignity, we would have had food. Man bringing home wages is a good man. Then the wife can hold up her head, and she can go out to the shop and say, give me a half a pound of rashers. Oh, give me a half a dozen eggs. We're having rashers and eggs of a Sunday morning, like all the other women in the lane, and people look at you and respect you because you're having rashers and eggs. We didn't have that. We didn't have any dignity. He deprived us of dignity. The hunger was bad enough, but to have to go out in rags, literally rags, go to school in shoes that he had cobbled out of bicycle tires, and as we used to say, we'd go to school with our arses hanging out of our pants, that was the worst part of it all. And that was the psychological effects of the poverty were something that I don't think we ever got over. It took us years. We were damaged. And then the other ingredient in life in Limerick was the church. Limerick prided itself on being the holiest city in Ireland, where the favorite word of the Limerick woman was no, where they were known for the ferocity of their chastity. We grew up under this cloud all the time. Well, in school, although the Irish Constitution states there's no official religion, Catholicism is not the official religion of Ireland. It's not the state religion. Still, it was the state religion. It was in the school that I went to, Leamy's National School, it was taught. We were taught Catholicism. We were taught the catechism. That was the beginning for me of literature, the catechism. What we call in America the Baltimore Catechism. It was the question and answer catechism for first confession and first communion. There were two catechisms, the green one for first confession and the red one for confirmation. And I think that was my exposure to what you might call theology and doctrine, dogma. The opening line, the opening question was, who made the world? That's a hell of a question for a five-year-old. But you didn't have to think about it. You were told, God. Who is God? God is the creator and sovereign Lord of heaven and earth and of all things. Why did God make the world? That's an even more cosmic. And that's where I first, that was my first sad encounter with theology, because I forgot the answer. I was supposed to memorize it, and I said, God made the world so we'd all have something to stand on, sir. And I was knocked around the room for this. So the more I look back at it, the more I realize how powerful was this conditioning. We had to, in addition to that, we had to memorize everything. There was no exploration into anything. There were no kindly American teachers that would say, let's talk about Bolivia today. Sit down. Sit up. McCord, who made the world? God. Who is God? God is the creator, sovereign, Lord of heaven. McCord, what are the chief towns of County Mayo? Castlebar, Westport, Killala, and Ballinawa, sir. You had to know, just trot it out. We had to memorize poetry, not for any enjoyment. We had to memorize all of the deserted village of Oliver Goldsmith. All of it, 26 pages of it. And we had to know all the songs and lamentations of Ireland's sufferings down through the 800 years of British tyranny. My father was an expert in the dying speeches of executed Irish rebels. Be it for the defense or be it for the assertions of a nation's liberty, I look upon the sword as a sacred weapon, or Robert Emmet, until Ireland takes her place among the nations of the earth, then and not till then shall my epitaph be written. We knew all of this, and we were privy to the last moments of every executed Irish rebel. This was our television. This was our entertainment. We didn't have television. We didn't have radio. Nothing came between us and our lives. Nothing. I'm jumping a bit. When I became a teacher in New York many, many years later, I had to deal with the lives removed from lives that eventually, no matter what occasion you find yourself in American life now, if you're at dinner, the talk inevitably and sadly moves towards what's on television, or if that fails, movies. It's our only common reference point. And I'm jumping now from Ireland to my teaching career for a reason. That when I was teaching, I had to become American. I had to become familiar with what was going on in their lives. When I said to my students, what did you do on Saturday mornings? I knew what they did, but I didn't know in any detail. What did you do on Saturday mornings? They watched TV. What did you see on TV? Cartoons. What were the cartoons? And then the class erupted in a recital of animals of all kinds of monsters, rats, cats, mice, snakes, monsters, dinosaurs, everything. And I said, holy, wait. And I threw them pieces of chalk, and I said, list them on the board. And, of course, the favorites were mice. First of all, Mickey Mouse, and so on. And then cats and dogs, and all in that order. And then we get, but there were no, there were snakes, and there were kindly monsters, and so on. And I was learning. Jesus, I said, this is American mythology. This is it. Forget about Greece and Rome. Forget about Olympus. This is American mythology. And my own favorite from the few times I saw him was Bugs Bunny. And I was able to make a brilliant parallel between Bugs Bunny and Odysseus. Because I was trying to motivate the kids to read Homer, and I said, "Well, they have all they have similar characteristics, all except one. They were both cunning and charming and strategic, etc. And they had a mean streak, and funny. There was only one difference: Odysseus had a mission to get home. Bugs Bunny was just drifting around, tormenting Elmer Fudd." This was my real education. And when you compare that, what went on in a high school classroom with what went on in a classroom in Ireland, there was a big difference.
You're listening to Mary Gordon and Frank McCourt in Portland in 1998. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and there's more from Gordon and McCourt coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time it's Mary Gordon and Frank McCourt. Back to their conversation now in Portland from 1998.
Frank and I have been interviewed probably much too much between us, and so we decided that we would talk for change about something that interviewers usually don't ask us, but something that's very important to writers, maybe one of the most important things, and that is what we read. So, Frank, read any good books lately?
Well, I'm avoiding anything Irish because I'm writing myself, so I don't want to be. In fact, the last book I finished was A Civil Action. But that case in Boston, well, Woburn, Massachusetts, which I couldn't put down. I was in a taxi a few weeks ago in New York, and I told the taxi he was delivering me something, and I had to sit in the taxi and finish the last six pages because that kind of writing is so packed with facts and so knowledgeable. I'm left in awe. I sometimes I pick up a book and say, could I have written that? And I couldn't have written that because of the kind of research, because of the technical knowledge about the environment, the chemistry, and toxicity in the and the law. So I'm in awe of people who write like that. I'm in awe of people like yourself writing novels, creating something out of nothing. So that my reading, and as I mentioned to you the other night. My bedtime reading is M.F.K. Fisher. There are certain women, my wife doesn't mind me saying this, there are certain women that I have fallen in love with from a distance, in time or in place. M.F.K. Fisher, I would have run away with her at any age. And Billie Holiday. I would have run away with Billie Holiday. And there was a woman.
M.F.K. Fisher was a better cook.
So yes, she was. I don't think I. With Billie Holiday, I think I would have starved to death.
I think so, yeah. One of the things that you were talking about, both as a writer and as a teacher of writing and literature, is that what it really is about is finding your own voice. And what writers do you think helped you find your own voice, or which ones got in the way?
There were certain writers along the way that you knew that were unique, and I read English writers long before I read the likes of James Joyce or Frank O'Connor. This is what we had. This is what was available. We weren't exactly running around Limerick reading Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake. I think I mentioned Samuel Butler's The Way of All Flesh, which for some had a powerful impact on me when I was a kid because of one particular scene. Butler was constantly concerned with the horrors of civilization, of the Industrial Revolution, and the beauty of pastoral life in England, and he has. Old man Pontifex, the head of the family, a farmer, who used to go every afternoon. This sounds almost Buddhist. Every afternoon, towards at twilight, he would stand at a gate and watch the sun go down. The old man. He was illiterate, but he spawned a great brood of intellectuals, ministers, and professors. But he would stand at the gate with his arms on top of the gate and look at the sun go down. And that's the way he declined into old age. He did it every night. And one night he was found dead. looking at the sun. And that summed up the whole feeling about pastoral living, and it's haunted me ever since. What about you, Mary? What do you read?
I have a secret vice, which is I sort of addicted to Proust. Every morning I read 10 pages of Proust, not in French. One day I'll read it in French. But one of the really, really great things about being brought up Catholic is you can feel guilty about anything. And I'm now in my fourth reading of Proust, and when I started the fourth reading, I felt really guilty about it because I enjoyed it too much, and there were so many things I hadn't written. And, you know, Balzac really has written a lot of novels that I haven't read because I haven't wanted to. But I thought simply not having wanted to was a good reason to read them. And my husband is a Midwestern Protestant, and he said, well, but if you like Proust, why don't you read him? I hadn't thought of that. So I read Proust a lot. Because I'm going to write something that has a political dimension to it in my next novel. I'm reading a lot of Conrad, who you can really, the man really saw. You can learn a great deal about seeing. I've been rediscovering the works of Jean Stafford, whom I think is a really fabulous and underrated writer. If you're in love with M.F.K. Fisher, I'm in love with Ford Madox Ford. He's the writer that I both want to read and date.
Oh.
So I've been reading him a lot. Well,
the other night we were in Seattle, I think there was a slight difference of opinion about Hemingway.
Yeah, I think he's responsible for everything bad in the world. Including toxic waste and El Nino.
Yeah.
I may be exaggerating, but I don't think so.
I was trying to explain to you why there were certain... I love The Old Man and the Sea, for obvious reasons. Grace under pressure and all of that. Much better than bullfighting. But I was explaining why I liked the way he handled details. And you were... I was talking about a short story of his called Big Two-Hearted River, where Nick Adams goes out into the woods, and he's alone, he's fishing. He's been through the First World War. And why I liked Hemingway, the way Hemingway showed us the details of the outdoor life, how Nick Adams opens a can and pours the contents into a pot, puts it on the fire, and the contents begin to bubble. And I said it was beans. Mary said it was spaghetti. She was very dogmatic about this.
And I don't know where I got that trait. I don't know where I got that trait of dogmatism.
However, Mary, it's a draw because one of our friends in Seattle brought me a Xerox copy of the page saying it was a can of pork and beans and spaghetti.
See what I mean? That's what literature does.
That's what I thought of. Details.
I guess I wouldn't. What I dislike about Hemingway, and it's hard because I dislike him as a person, but I think he had a malign effect on American letters, and that's one reason why I dislike him. I think I do believe that the novel is the bastard child of journalism and poetry, and in his insistence, and I can understand the impulse behind cutting out the fat in. A lot of that late Victorian prose was pretty otiose, but he, in his insistence that prose had to be telegraphic, and his insistence that it only had to be one way, he was a bully presence in American literature, and I think he made people believe that that prose had to be unadorned and stripped of its poetry. I think there's no accident that when Fitzgerald died, all his books were out of print. And there are other strains in American literature, the strain of Willa Cather, for example, which is a very clear and yet rich prose, the strain of Fitzgerald, the strain of Faulkner, which always seems to be fighting its way for air against these kind of strictures that the bully Hemingway sat down. And I wonder, you know, as I was listening to you read, I'm always struck by the poetry of your style, and I feel that that Hemingway, in his sort of bully virility, distrusted poetry, and I think that's been unfortunate.
But didn't he write poetry? I know it was terrible, but he recognized the importance of poetry.
But not in prose.
And he was a great admirer of Joyce's particular style, if you want to call it that. But I think he was a great admirer. He said Joyce has written a damn good book, and he'd knock around Paris with Joyce and follow him like an acolyte. So I think the whole atmosphere of Hemingway doesn't appeal to me. All that testosterone, which gives me such a pain. All that bullfighting and fighting and manliness. I really hate manliness. I can't stand it. That's,
you know, it's been a hit, though. You know.
Yeah, it's been a hit. It's with us.
Yeah.
But I think it's the moments that I like in him, the private moments, not the social moments. Because that's what I liked about Jane Austen. When Jane Austen would gather a group of people together, I said I would quiver with excitement when she would say there's going to be a party in Emma. And I said, now how is she going to handle this? Because I love the way certain novelists move their people around the room, especially in that period in history where, well, what the hell are they doing? They're all in a room. You know, the New York cocktail party where you're standing nose to nose with a glass of white wine, clashing with the other glass of white wine. But in Jane Austen's, they're what are they doing? Crocheting. They're crocheting, or they're writing letters.
Yeah.
So-and-so's are ignoring the rest of the people. This is supposed to be a party, but they're off writing letters. And then they come in and they mingle, and I think she's the precursor of Henry James.
Yeah.
in the way they handle those situations. It's cinematic in a way. How would a director move them around?
Well, to me, one of the most absolutely anguishing scenes in literature, it's almost unbearable, is the scene in Pride and Prejudice when the sister Mary, the plain one, the musical one, is playing and singing badly. And the family is just mortified. Well, to me, that's more blood and guts than anything Hemingway ever dreamed of. I mean, if you were to talk about violence,
but I'm not talking about violence at all. I was talking to you last night about the fishing scene where he's with Jake is with his. I can't remember the character's name. And they have this serene moment before the craziness at the bull running. It was that kind of thing. Well, he just appreciated. Of course, it was man and man.
Yeah.
He sees Lady Brett Ashley is a man.
Sure.
She goes out with the chaps. So it's those moments where he's almost that. I think where the little boy or the poet, maybe it's the poet, crept through that I liked about it. Maybe it was a sense of relief for me that he dropped all the nonsense, the testosterone nonsense.
Well, it seems to me though that there's an interesting problem that you had to face, a problem of voice, coming, and I had to face a similar one. You're in America, but you're Irish, and when you're trying to find this voice, it has to be a voice, because if a voice is going to have resonance, it has to reflect the richness of your experience. And as I was listening to you read, I thought about what you were saying about the influence of the liturgy, which is an embellished language and a formal language and a language in which repetition is very, very important. Do you feel that the poetry of the liturgy was an important influence on you? There's the rhetoric of sermon, but there are all those litanies
that
we heard.
Well, we in school we recited the litany every day at noon.
Yeah.
And in Irish. And share of it, a bit, share of it, a bit, share of it. And the masters would rush through because they want to get it over, but it was in Irish. And we respond, there was no sense of prayer. But we had to learn all the prayers in Irish, and a lot of them in Latin, although we didn't understand the Latin. We had to learn the Apostles' Creed and the Confiteor and the Latin responses in the Mass. So I don't know what effect that had on me. I think it gave us a sense of the glory of language.
Yeah.
It's so sad nowadays to see how flat language is. And I was certainly certainly exposed to that as a high school teacher, because I used to fulminate against the kids. I'm like to her, and I'm like, you know. I say, what? You're like what? You mean, I said to her, I go to her. So verbal crutches, cool. So cool. I have a niece, and she can hardly utter four words. Cool. Cool, like, you know, sort of. I'm like, how old are you? I'm like 16. Are you or are you not 16? I get very, I know you do, you get very impatient with this.
But on the other hand, if you listen to things like rap,
yeah,
which, you know, I have to say I'm not in love with, but I do think, in an odd way, it is that same linguistic principle, yeah, of repetition and invention and embellishment, and I don't think it's going to go away. Well, then are you worried? Where's literature going to go? Are we the end of the road, Frank?
Oh, no.
Are we going to be?
No, you know that when you go around the country, you meet people from book clubs. And they're meeting all over America at this very moment, and they call you when my book first came out. It might be midnight in New York, but it's 9 p.m. in Arizona. Mr. McCourt, yeah. Frank McCourt, yeah. Really, yeah. Are you the man who wrote Angela's Ashes? Yeah. Oh, really? Really? Well, I'm here with my book club, and we're wondering. So it's book clubs are springing up all over the place, and independent booksellers are having a rough time, but books are being sold.
But what is the... If you and I were brought up with a kind of... The alternately crushing and enlivening cloak of the church, which gave us, I think all religious traditions do it, particularly the black religious tradition of a very high rhetorical style and the call and response. Minus that, what is going to be, what will be for young writers? What will be the source of the grandeur? What will be the source of love of language? Also, the thing about, what you need to understand is that we were really scared when we were children. As Frank said, it wasn't a metaphor. We were completely terrified. On the other hand, we thought life was very serious, and that there were things which had eternal stakes on them.
Well, rap is one example of the glory of language, the excitement over language, and I think you get black kids who take language and like the metaphysical poets, wrench it apart and put it back together again, because they don't have the respect for the English language that we did. We observed all the rules and wrote complete sentences, but they don't. And when you look at E.E. Cummings, there isn't much respect for the English language, though he knew what he was doing, and Eliot knew what he was doing. But they wrench it apart and put it back together again. And we don't know where we're going with this. We'd like to think that the English language is in place, but we know it's changing, and it will change forever. But we know there are, in America, which is the liveliest place in the world as far as language is concerned, there are all kinds of Asian people pouring in, Hispanics, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and they're going to do very strange things with the language, which if we were to come back in 500 years, we'd find unsettling. But then there's also the people who appreciate the grandeur of old standard English. I think that'll go on.
Well, let's get back to our reading. Is there any writer who's a danger for you, Frank, that you feel like you have to stay away from, and what does the danger consist of?
Oh, Beckett. I have to stay away from Samuel Beckett. I can't. Right. For me, you can't eat just one. If I read him, I'm writing like him. I just stay away from him. He's the most powerful influence of all. And then Swift, if I read any of Swift's prose, I'm engaging in savage indignation. And his great sense of merriment. I think they're the two.
And yet, in a lot of your prose, in the playfulness of the prose, yeah. In some of the ways in which language itself plays with you and puts you into a corner, I see Beckett's touch, and it's not a malign touch. Would you say we're in danger from the writers who give us the most, in a way?
I don't know. I think all of the writers you've ever read are pouring into your vessel. Do you think of when you're writing a novel or a memoir? Do writers come into your head?
They do, and I have one of the things that I do to get over the dread that I feel every single morning when I confront my own stupidity and the vast blankness of the page, which is a bad combination. The size of my stupidity and the size of the page. One of the things that relaxes me is to read other writers. I sometimes even copy sentences. Frank and I share a dirty little secret, which is that we don't use computer, we write in longhand. And I could really talk about my fountain pen, but I don't want to get dirty. For me to copy down the prose of other writers is immensely calming. I think it makes me feel not alone, and it also makes me just the rhythms of somebody great who's gone before me almost enter into my bloodstream, and it calms me down. I have to be. Virginia Woolf has a phrase in The Waves in which Neville needs a particular tone. And in order to write that day, he needs the tone of Byron. There's some mornings when I'm just so nervous because I need a tone and I don't know what it is. And then the tuning fork is hit. And okay, I needed the Dubliners that day, or I needed Catherine Ann Porter that day. And then I can almost go. So I feel the company of writers is very important. Jean Rhys once said that writing is like an enormous lake. And there are a couple of great tributaries like Shakespeare and Tolstoy, and a writer just has to keep feeding the lake, and the only important thing is to make sure that your little trickle is pure. I think I feel very accompanied by writers.
You're not alone.
No, I don't like feeling alone. It's
well,
just
I think
very...
In the past I've had baleful influences. When I was younger, I had to avoid P.G. Woodhouse.
Well, you had so much in common.
Yeah,
that was...
Oh, yeah. I Jeeves.
Yeah. Well, the subject matter, if nothing else, was almost identical.
Yeah. But, you know, he's so merry and so playful. He had such little tricks this was a long time ago before I think I discovered accidentally that in my one book I discovered the perspective of a child, and I was imitating everybody. This is the strangest thing of all, and I don't know how the hell I'm going to write about it. How can you stand in front of high school classes every day and exhort them to be honest and to find their own voice, their own style, to imitate nobody, go home and tell your story, when in doubt, begin with once upon a time. How can you stand in front of all these kids and then go home and struggle and not hear your own voice? I don't know. This is the mystery to me. And it took maybe 7 or 8 years after I retired from teaching before I found that voice. I'm not saying that's my voice. That was the voice of the child that I was. I don't know what I'll do from here on. If I were a novelist, I wouldn't know what to do with myself.
Well, speaking about Bugs Bunny, being a novelist is like being Bugs Bunny, because you know how Bugs Bunny is walking along a cliff, and he's walking along a cliff, and then all of a sudden he's walking and there's no cliff. And he looks down and he realizes he better make some cliff for himself or else he's going to really crash. That's what being a novelist is. Yeah. You always have to be making the cliff under yourself. So I think the important thing that we've taught you tonight is the literary influence of Bugs Bunny. And I think we'll close with that.
Thank you.
That was Mary Gordon and Frank McCourt in conversation at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1998. Gordon and McCourt are both award-winning authors and beloved teachers. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.